Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the New York primary results are in, and we'll tell you from the controller to the high-profile congressional races, who won, who lost, and what's next as we head into the midterms. Our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, explains how astronauts tracked down a dangerous air leak on the International Space Station using an unexpectedly simple tool. Plus, new research suggests mosquitoes might be able to learn to seek out DEET, and scientists may have finally solved the mystery of the T-Rex's tiny arms. Plus, writer and visual artist Javi Brock joins us to discuss the Crazy River Project, a multimedia exploration of rivers, landscapes, and conservation, and celebrating Pride at Berryville's Pussycat Lounge. After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is heading to Capitol Hill today for lunch with Senate Republicans. NPR's Sam Greenglass reports the meeting comes as tensions between Trump and his congressional colleagues are especially high.
Just last night, four Republicans joined with Democrats to advance a resolution directing Trump to pull troops from the conflict with Iran. But before that, Trump was already venting frustration with Senate Majority Leader John Thune, pressing him to eliminate the filibuster to pass a strict voter ID law, even saying that anyone who opposes the idea is a fool. And without the Save America Act, Republicans will never win another election. Thune says there just aren't the votes to pass it. The president's demands keep complicating shared priorities like reauthorizing a key spy tool and passing immigration funding. Frustrated Republicans worry Trump's focus on 2020 over 2026 could risk their majority. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
Europe is in the grip of a deadly, record-setting heat wave. Dozens of people have died from heat-related causes or by drowning as they try to cool off. And some of the continent's infrastructure has been brought to a standstill. NPR's Lauren Frere reports from Manchester in northern England.
British authorities are urging people not to travel amid only the second extreme heat warning of this severity in history. Here at Manchester Piccadilly Station, lots of trains are canceled. Others are delayed because they're forced to drive slower on overheated tracks. Across the country, more than 1,000 schools have shut because they don't have air conditioning. In London, even some events for Climate Action Week had to be scrapped. And United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the conference,
"London isn't just calling. It's cooking."
France recorded its hottest day since records began 80 years ago. The Eiffel Tower and the Louvre had to close early. Lauren Frayer, NPR News in Manchester, England.
Stocks on Wall Street opened higher this morning as investors wait for fresh signals about the artificial intelligence boom. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Computer chip maker Micron is set to report quarterly earnings later today, and investors will be on the lookout for any signs about the staying power of the AI boom. Micron shares were hammered on Tuesday, but they're still way up since the beginning of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average wants to capture a bit more of the AI frenzy. The people who manage the index are adding Google's parent company next week. Verizon will drop out of the Dow to make way for Google's parent Alphabet. Crude oil prices continue to slide as tanker traffic through the Strait of Hormuz picks up. AAA says the average price of diesel fuel in the U.S. has dropped below $5 a gallon, though it's still more than a dollar a gallon higher than it was when the U.S. launched its war with Iran. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Congress has approved a bipartisan housing bill aimed at addressing the nation's housing shortage and making homes more affordable. Lawmakers say the measure is designed to boost construction, cut red tape, and encourage more development. The legislation also includes restrictions on large institutional investors buying up single-family homes. Supporters call it the most significant federal housing measure in decades. The bill now heads to President Trump for his signature. Nearly 8 in 10 Gen Zers say they want a job that allows them to help others. That's according to a new Gallup poll examining how young people feel about their purpose in life. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
Gallup surveyed close to 2,500 people, ages 13 through 28. A large majority of them said they hope to make a positive difference in people's lives through work. The sentiment was shared across the full range of Gen Zers, regardless of age, gender, race, and financial status. The reality, based on the polling, is that not everyone is achieving that. Among those 18 and older who have jobs, just over half say they currently feel they're helping others through their work. Gallup asked about barriers standing in the way. About half cited insufficient pay as one factor that could prevent them from pursuing such a job. And close to half said jobs that make a positive difference are hard or emotionally draining. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Stocks are trading higher on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow was up 114 points. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. New York voters made their choices in a series of closely watched primary elections that could shape the state's political landscape and influence the battle for control of Congress this fall. And the results offer new clues about voter priorities and party strategy heading into November. To help us break down the winners, losers, and what it all means, we're joined by Samuel King, the New York Public News Network's Capital Bureau reporter. How are you, Samuel?
I'm all right. Good morning. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I want to get into some of these high-profile races, but first, what stands out to you most from the primary results across New York yesterday?
I think it's pretty clear just what's coming out of New York City with the success of Mayor Mamdani, the mayor of New York City, of course, and the backing of three congressional candidates who were mostly to the left of their opponents, probably except in New York 7. But even then, so just the power of his endorsement, particularly in New York 13, where Darylisa Avila Xavier is defeated the incumbent congressperson, Adriano Espaillat, who is the head of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, probably Mamdani's endorsement and support for her kind of maybe pushed her over the top. And also, down the ballot, several DSA members won Democratic Assembly primary, so their numbers will increase in Albany next year as well. But for the rest of the state, there's sort of mixed results. DSA person prevailing out in Buffalo, a very tight race with an incumbent assemblyman in Syracuse, where DSA supported county legislator was challenging. So we'll see how that sort of plays out, but that's clearly probably the headline from last night.
Yeah, the headline in the New York Times is Mamdani emerges as kingmaker. So showing his influence for his slate in the primaries. But let's talk about some of the higher profile races. The only statewide race was for state controller. Tom DiNapoli successfully fended off a challenge to challengers. What does his victory say about Democratic voters' appetite for experience and continuity in that office?
Yeah, it's interesting. He's sort of like the Energizer Bunny of state politics. Just keep going and going. The challengers felt that this year was the year. He's been in office for 19 years. They challenged him for the left, but I think in the end, he's sort of had the name recognition, such as it is for the state comptroller. Not many people, fully know what they have, what they do. Had the support of the establishment. You saw Attorney General Tish James do a ad for him. He had support of labor unions. And I think just in the end, Democratic voters didn't really feel the need to make a change there. It could be argued that if there had just been one challenger, maybe, the results might have been different. But certainly, he was one of the first races called last night, so we won fairly comfortably.
Yeah, pretty big margin of victory there, so not a lot of surprises. But do you think that since progressives invested so much energy into the race, do you think they've taken any lessons away from this result?
Well, I think it's, now they did, unseat, end up unseating some incumbents. But I think for someone like DiNapoli, who is just so entrenched, he definitely took the race seriously. You know, he wasn't, you know, caught asleep at the switch as we've seen some incumbents do before. So it, for some of these, you know, progressives, it, you know, in some of these races, it'll be tough for them to do. But I think one thing that DiNapoli pointed to in his statement last night was, you know, voters wanted that sort of a steady and reliable leadership that he's applied. And, you know, when you're talking about pension funds and things like, you know, you have to make the argument that the better thing you want, if you're saying it's going to be a better thing, is better than the good thing that people have going now. And it appeared that Democratic voters at least didn't see any change. And we'll see what happens in November. He does have a Republican opponent, Joseph Hernandez, entrepreneur, business owner, investor.
One of the most competitive House districts in the entire country is New York 17th. Kate Conley emerged from five Democratic folks in the primary there to be the victor and will go on to face Mike Lawler in November. What do we think that tells us about the candidate that was chosen there in that really important race, that swing district that could to tip the balance of power?
Yeah, definitely more of, you know, unlike probably in the city, definitely had more of the candidate that, you know, you would stereotypically think would prevail in a swing district, someone who has military background, a counterintelligence background, trying to show that she has sort of, you know, we go back to that steady, reliable leadership. And I guess just goes to show that, you know, politics, you know, they say all politics is local, and this is certainly a thing. This is clearly who Mike Lawler probably didn't want to face. There are some reports that, you know, he was sort of working behind the scenes to boost other candidates in the primary. But in the end, you know, the voters went with Kate Conley, which is setting up a very, as you said, competitive race. Has been in the past. It's one of the few Republican-held seats that went to Kamala Harris in 2024. I believe there's only three of them, and this is one of them. So definitely going to see a lot of money and resources on both sides poured into this race.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking to Samuel King from the New York Public News Network about the primary results from last night's New York primary. In our listening area, the 19th Congressional District, there was a Republican primary. Peter Oberrocker won there, beating his challenger, Alex Pertelli. And now we'll go on to face Josh Riley. How competitive is this district in the scheme of things?
Yeah, this is another district that is competitive sort of on the other side, having a Democratic incumbent. It's definitely one that Republicans want to take, and this is just going to be another sort of battleground district as they work to maintain control of the House. You mentioned Senator Oberrocker. He definitely had the support of most people sort of in the party. This was sort of, he had definitely been angling to take on Riley in the fall. So I think this is going to be another district where you see a lot of resources poured into for sure. And it does, you know, take up a lot of real estate in New York, from the Catskills all the way over to Finger Lakes. Definitely another one that people will be watching this year.
And the New York 21 Republican primary was a particularly intense competition there between the two candidates. One of them, the Trump-endorsed candidate, won the primary. This is for Elise Stefanik's House seat. What does that tell us about President Trump's influence in the congressional races in New York?
Definitely, he, you know, still clearly has a lot of influence, and Anthony Constantino definitely benefited from that endorsement. I think that's pretty clear, despite a lot of the party apparatus in New York State, you know, rallying behind Smolin and supporting Smolin. Definitely the energy in that campaign was definitely with Constantino, and the party now that he is the nominee, he has rallied around him and sort of, you know, coalesced around him. Even Elise Stefanik, who did not notably endorse during the campaign, came out last night and gave her full support to Constantino and posts on social media. So definitely the Trump effect was very strong in that race. And Smolin does have the conservative party line. There are some rough feelings between them and Constantino. So we'll see what happens with that. You know, usually in a lot of cases, the party person steps aside, and the conservative party would, or, you know, in the Democratic side, Working Families Party sort of endorses those candidates. So we'll see what happens there. He hasn't sort of closed the door on that yet at last report. But definitely the Trump factor will be big for both parties. And I think you saw that on both sides, sort of the Republican base rallying around, Donald Trump and Republicans in the Democratic base wanting people who will put the fight to Trump and feeling that, you know, some of the candidates had not done enough to do so.
Were there any results that caught you as an observer off guard?
No, I think the only not sort of off guard. I mean, it was interesting just to see the breadth of support for the DSA candidates in New York City, but it just goes to show sort of, as we talked about at the beginning, sort of the power of the Mamdani endorsement. And then sort of the down ballot races too, which leads to next year in Albany, where it won't be an election year. There was some discontent among progressives and DSA in Albany about, you know, not taxing the rich per se, not doing some of these more progressive things. So now that DSA will have more numbers, it'll be interesting to see sort of how that relates to, you know, party dynamics and what policies that lawmakers pass next year, and what's expected to be a tighter budget year than this year.
And there's only 132 days, a little over 4 months until November's election. Now we'll start seeing a little bit more activity in that governor's race between Governor Hochul and her challenger, Bruce Blakeman. Are you looking to see this as a particularly nasty battle?
Yes. In some ways, it already is. They're already sort of trading barbs on social media. I've already seen Bruce Blakeman trying to tie these results to the governor. Notably, the governor sort of endorsed in some of the congressional races. The only sort of one that she won, so to speak, was Michael Lasher's race in New York City. And she was actually spoke at his victory party last night. So we're already seeing sort of the battle lines form sort of behind the scenes. But assuredly now that the primaries are behind them. And again, they were unopposed, so they did not face a primary last night. So we'll definitely see that, but certainly an uphill battle for Bruce Blakeman, but he's hoping to, of course, replicate and do better than Lee Zeldin, who, you know, finished within 6 points of Governor Hochul in 2022, and he's obviously hoping to make that ground and then some and prevail. So a lot of resources go to that as well.
What do you think voters should be paying attention to between now and November? And what are you paying attention to?
Well, I think it will. That's a good point. Good question. I think sort of the affordability question, I think that's the big one that both sides are playing out. Also, sort of how the governor and some of the other candidates sort of manage this, if they feel they need to manage this sort of strong support from the left in New York City, and how that messaging might impact them and other candidates, not only in New York, but sort of across the country, because clearly Republicans are going to tie them. But, you know, on the other hand, we did, again, see some support for the left in other areas, and they prevailed even in some areas in the city that aren't traditionally, you know, thought of as sort of friendly to them. A lot of these candidates won. So I think the messaging that comes out and sort of how they appeal to answering some of the problems that voters have when it comes to, you know, the economy and utility prices and public safety and immigration and things like that.
And another thing folks should be paying attention to at the local level is that change in the even year elections guidance. So folks who were just elected last year at the local level, most of them are going to be running again in November. So there's a lot for folks to consider this November. Samuel King is from the Capitol Bureau from the New York Public News Network. And Samuel, we thank you for your time today. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon.
Okay. Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, science stories from Joe Johnson, our resident science guy. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at sullivan180.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at wjffradio.org.
Wherever you go, take Radio Catskill with you. Stream your favorite shows, music, and podcasts anytime, anywhere with our new and improved app. Stay connected with local news and national headlines all in one place. You can even send us your thoughts with the Talk to Us feature, audio or video, right from your phone. No radio? No problem. Just press play. It's Radio Catskill right in your pocket. Download the app today on iPhone or Android.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A leaking module aboard the International Space Station's surprising new findings about mosquito repellents and fresh clues about why Tyrannosaurus Rex had such tiny arms. Those are the science stories that caught the eye of our resident science guy, Joe Johnson.
The ISS, the International Space Station, has apparently had a air leak problem. Now, this is, I saw lots of news reports pop up, and they were all based on a press release from NASA and some other sources. But like I said, it was about an air leak on the ISS. You got to remember that it's 14.7 pounds per square inch inside, but outside, essentially no pressure. There's a vacuum, so air is constantly wanting to leak out. This was first detected back in 2019. You got to remember that the space station is 27 years old at this point, and so some leakage is expected. But back in 2020, the leak increased, and it was eventually located in the Zvezda module. This is a transfer module that actually connects the living quarters to the aft docking port where spacecraft dock. It's a connecting tunnel surrounded by equipment inside a shell on the outside of the station. The tunnel's made from aluminum alloy, and this is the part that shocked me. That aluminum alloy is left over from the Mir program, from the Soviet Mir program back in the 1980s.
Wow.
And they recycled it. They reused it. It was a backup piece that they never flew, but they were able to reuse it. Now, remember, it's connected to the aft docking module, and this is where spacecraft like the Progress and stuff like that is coming in. Over 100 dockings have been done there. And so this tunnel has been subject to quite a bit of stress. Now, previous leaks, and these are like little microscopic cracks, were treated with different types of sealants, but it's unclear if that helped very much. Now, recently, past June 5th, the leak accelerated to almost about 2 pounds of air per day that they were losing. And they tried all kinds of technology to find the leak. Remember, these are tiny microscopic hairline leaks. They tried thermal imaging, they tried ultrasound machines, they tried microphones to actually hear the air going out. But what worked in the end was really low technology. They took some finely ground tea leaves and they suspended them in the air in the module and they saw where they collected. They're going to move towards, you know, where the air is flowing out. Right. And they were able to find this little hairline crack. And this is where it gets a little strange. Each module on the space station is the dominion of the country that actually built it. So because this was a Russian module, it was the Russian engineers that were trying to figure this out. And they decided that they wanted to remove a bracket they wanted to like saw out this bracket to better access the
saw
leak.
Saw out?
Yes, they were going to saw it out. And NASA disagreed, thinking that it would compromise the structure of the module, and they ordered 5 of the 7 astronauts that were NASA astronauts into the docked SpaceX Crew Dragon spacecraft in what's known as a safe haven protocol. So if something went wrong, they would be in a safe haven. They would be in a safe place.
Well, I'm no astronaut, and I'm no engineer, but I would think that using a saw or anything like that in space might be a little tricky.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there were two other astronauts, Roscosmos astronauts, Russian astronauts aboard the ISS, and they were going to prepare to remove the bracket, and apparently cooler heads prevailed. And after a couple of hours, the procedure was canceled. So they were in the spacecraft. The 5 astronauts were in the spacecraft for about 2 hours. And in the end, it was decided to decommission the module and permanently seal the hatch. Now, due to the foresight of the engineers, The ISS has three more docking hatches, you know, where spacecraft can dock to transfer personnel and materials and stuff like that. So it's not like they're cut off, but the aft module was the one that's the easiest to dock at.
Sounds like the scariest home repair project ever. You mentioned that this is an aging spacecraft, or the ISS is really old. Is there any indication that they're going to create something new?
Well, NASA plans to deorbit it, which means crash it into the Atlantic, and sometime before the end of 2030. They think that by then it will have served its purpose, and we certainly don't want to leave it in orbit to come down somewhere, you know, haphazardly. They're going to shift to commercially run space stations and shift their focus to more deep space exploration and get out of the space station business.
All right, let's talk about your other science story, which is fascinating to me. Could bug spray with DEET in it, which is supposed to repel mosquitoes, actually be doing the opposite?
Well, okay, so we got to start with the background here. DEET is N-dimethyl metatoluamide mosquito repellent. It's the gold standard for mosquito repellents. It was created by the USDA in 1944 to protect U.S. military personnel in the Pacific during World War II. It's used globally by millions of people each year. And you got to remember that about a million people yearly die from mosquito-borne diseases. So it's important. The exact chemical mechanism, however, of the repulsion, why does it repel the mosquitoes, is unknown. Is it toxic to them? Is it unpleasant to them? Or does it block a mosquito's ability to detect humans? So scientists at Tours University in France, they wanted to find out how strong this aversion was. So they designed and carried out an experiment where lab-raised mosquitoes were trained to associate the smell of DEET with a blood meal. So they actually trained them, they conditioned them to know that DEET would give them a meal. The species was Aedes aegypti, which can carry dangerous viruses, yellow fever, dengue fever, chikungunya, which is a new one to me, I'd never heard of that, and Zika. And so then they trained these mosquitoes, these lab-raised mosquitoes, to do this. And then an experimenter placed her hands in a chamber with the mosquitoes, one of which was treated with DEET and one was not. And about 60% of the mosquitoes actually went to the hand treated with DEET.
Talk about being dedicated to your research. Wow.
Probably a grad student. So what does they say? They say, the researchers say, that this means that DEET should be applied and reapplied according to instructions, because it does evaporate off the body. It is absorbed into the body, and so it loses its effectiveness after a little while. And so they say you should reapply it. Now, if you're using 20 to 35% DEET, you know, concentration in the pesticide, well, I can't say pesticide, in the repellent, you should reapply it every 3 to 6 hours. And once again, more frequently if it's hot.
So they're not saying you shouldn't use product with DEET in it. It's just saying to reapply it more often than you would.
Right, normally. Right. Well, they say you should just follow the instructions and reapply it as they tell you to. Now, some last notes. First of all, DEET can damage. It's an organic molecule, so it can actually damage some plastics and synthetic fibers like rayon and nylon. So be careful with that. It can repel ticks, too, which is important in our part of the country. We don't have that many, you know, mosquito-borne diseases, but the number of tick-borne diseases in our area
especially this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you don't want to put it on your skin, you can apply it to your clothing. Spray it on your hats and your pant legs. And that will hopefully keep some of the mosquitoes and the ticks away.
Okay, let's move on to another pesky creature, Tyrannosaurus rex.
Tyrannosaurus rex, yeah.
Now, what have we found out about this predatory dinosaur?
Well, this was an article in the May 20th issue of the Proceedings of the Royal Society. Now, most kids and a lot of adults are fascinated with dinosaurs.
They love them.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that these creatures walked the Earth for millions of years and were wiped out by an asteroid strike about 65 million years ago is incredible, and it continues to interest people. I know a number of adults who are just fascinated with dinosaurs. Now, everyone has seen his reconstruction of Tyrannosaurus rex or seen a mounted skeleton of T-Rex like down at the American Museum of Natural History down in New York, they've noticed how small the forelimbs or the arms are compared to the rest of the body. It's got this massive head, this huge tail and hind limbs, but these comparatively tiny little arms.
Yeah, I mean, these things always been depicted like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were like up to 40 feet long, but their forelimbs, their arms were about 3 feet long. So, you know, my arm is probably just a little under 3 feet. So to think of a giant dinosaur with just these little tiny arms up front, there's been a lot of jokes over the years. And the question, of course, is why did this apex predator with these giant teeth, 6 to 12 inch long teeth, have such relatively small arms? Now, the scientists involved, which are from the University of London, looked not just at T-Rex, but about 80 different non-avian theropod dinosaurs, all of which had reduced forelimbs. It's not just T-Rex. There's about 80 or 85 of dinosaurs, fossils that we found, species that we found that are like this. And they represented five distinct branches of the theropod dinosaur family tree. Theropods, by the way, are dinosaurs that walk on two legs as opposed to four legs, like sauropods, right, and okay, stuff like that. Now, what they did was they were looking at the proportions of the bodies of these creatures, and what they found was as the heads and jaws of these dinosaurs became larger, the forelimbs became smaller. They saw an inverse relationship between what they termed head and neck robusticity and forelimb size. Okay, and the explanation that they came up with is that the head and the jaws were the primary weapons of these creatures. And so it makes sense that they would become larger and larger. One of the things to consider is that the prey of these theropods was very large, like sauropods and stuff like that, and a powerful bite and neck muscles were key to bringing them down. This is essentially an evolutionary trade-off where the forelimbs become almost vestigial as they become less necessary and less useful. An example might be the appendix in the human, that we don't need it anymore, and so it's become vestigial.
Hmm. Do they know? Well, you have a big head, you get tinier arms, because that's your main way of getting the prey with your jaws.
Right.
But were they completely useless, or do they know if there was any use?
Well, you know, one of the scientists that was interviewed said that they must have some use, or they would have just disappeared entirely. They would have just become, you know, gone. And so maybe it has something. One of the earlier theories had to do with them clasping mates during reproduction. Some said it has to do with mating rituals and stuff like that. So it's possible that they had some use, but I don't think it had to do with predation because they were just kind of useless for that. Now, because these animals came from five different lineages of theropod dinosaurs, the authors consider this to be an example of convergent evolution where different animals solved the same problem the same way. Think about bats, birds, and insects. They all developed wings and the ability to fly, but they're not anywhere nearly closely related to each other.
65 million years later, we're still learning more about all of these dinosaurs.
They're still fascinating to us.
Joe Johnson, so fascinating, the information you always bring us on Science Stories.
Always a good time.
Thank you. And we'll take a break. And when we come back, a conversation with writer and visual artist Javi Brock. We'll talk about his Crazy River project, the connection between art and environmental conservation. Stay with us. It's Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radio Lab,
Patient Zero.
Patient Zero.
Patient Zero.
Was probably a Bantu man.
Patient Zero was a man.
He kills a chimpanzee. And he cuts himself.
From the first HIV infection to the first high five.
Give him the high five handshake.
I had that feeling before everybody else did.
That's the moment. That's the moment it begins.
Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Jose Andres, a Spanish chef with 2 Michelin stars and 40 restaurants worldwide. As the founder of World Central Kitchen, Andres has fed tens of millions of people across dozens of crises, and he was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. Writer and visual artist Javi Brock is bringing his Crazy River project to two locations in the Catskills this week. Brock will discuss the project and its relationship to environmental stewardship at Frost Valley YMCA during an artist's talk at the newly opened gallery at Forstman Castle, and he's also exhibiting work at Material Project Space in Ellenville as part of Upstate Art Weekend. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Brock about the project, the exhibitions, and the stories behind the work.
Today, my guest is Hovey Brock. He's back here again at our studio, and he's here to talk about an upcoming artist talk, June 27th, Saturday at 3 p.m. That's over in Frost Valley at the gallery at Forstman Castle. And he is also part of Upstate Arts Weekend that runs Thursday the 25th through the 29th, and he will have his work displayed at Material Project Space in Ellenville. So we do have a lot to talk about.
Great. Thanks for inviting me, Valerie. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Let's begin with the artist talk. You are going to be talking about your Crazy River project, as well as the efforts going in to sustain the land and river at Frost Valley, correct?
That's right. I'm going to be in conversation with Dan DeCellis, who is a natural resources director at Frost Valley, and he's very knowledgeable. I've worked with Dan DeCellis before. We actually had a mutual problem in the valley dealing with a plant that is known as Japanese barberry. It's an invasive species, really hard to get rid of. Beautiful plant, but very difficult to get rid of. It's covered with like sharp spines that are made out of silica, so it's monstrously difficult to dig out. But anyway, he helped me with that. I also approached him with trying to deal with a beaver issue that we had in our water. We actually resolved it without his having to trap them out, so that was good. But anyway, I've known Dan for some time, great guy. And we're going to have a conversation about my art and how it relates to conservation in the valley and, you know, some of the problems that are facing the environment in Frost Valley. Frost Valley is a beautiful spot. If you've ever traveled through it, I'm sure you'll agree. Somebody, a friend of mine, likened it to Brigadoon.
I can place. See that.
Yeah, exactly. This place out of time. And it is, it's a lovely spot, but like the rest of the Catskills, it's facing a lot of issues. There's the issue of invasive species, which I previously touched on just now. There's also the issue of flooding, which is something that not only the Catskill face, but really the entire Appalachian chain is actually one of the most flood-prone areas in the world, amazingly enough.
Well, I didn't know that. Yeah. In the world.
In the world. It's a combination of its geology, you know, the weather patterns in the United States, but it is very prone to flooding, and the Catskills is no exception since it is really part of the Appalachian chain.
And you are a third generation.
That is right. My grandmother settled in Frost Valley in 1920. It's kind of a Cinderella story. She was taking care of this I wouldn't call him a robber baron, but he was very wealthy, Gilded Age type. And he had actually tried to find an heir for the land. He had 4,000 acres, quite a bit of land that he had been buying up over the period in Frost Valley as a hunting and fishing club. And my grandmother had been taking care of him in his old age. He first tried to give it away to Cornell. They said, thanks, but no thanks. And he didn't have any relatives that he could give it away to. So he finally said, well, Frank, her nickname was Frank. He said, Frank, I know it's a white elephant, but I would love it if you took it over. And she did.
Wow, what a story.
Isn't that a crazy story?
It is. It's like Crazy River.
Like Crazy River. Well, you know, stay tuned. I'm going to be writing a series of I'm going to try to publish a series of essays about, you know, my growing up in the Catskills and the story behind it.
And tell us a little bit about the origins of the name of the Neversink River.
Sure. So I may be treading on thin ice here because I got the translation for Crazy River off of a Lenape Talking Dictionary page that said that but Neversink is a corruption of the original Lenape, which means something like Crazy River. And I had originally heard this from my mother that it meant Crazy River. And then, you know, I went to the Lenape page and they said that it was also Crazy River. Now, there's lots of controversy. Well, maybe controversy isn't the right word, but there's lots of disagreement about what the word Neversink actually means. Some people think it means water originating in high ground. But I like the translation Crazy River. It sort of fits my project. I picked the title because I thought it was an interesting way of thinking about what's happening to the environment. A meteorologist said that with global warming, we're poking the climate with sharp sticks. I like to think that Crazy River, we're making the river a little crazy with what we're doing environmentally.
Communicate as a writer, but you also communicate as an artist. How do you see your art communicating to us?
Well, what I do is I make paintings that are basically autobiographically based about my experience growing up in the valley. I was never a full-time resident. I would go up there on summers, you know, and I would spend my summer vacation there. But the environment is something that I became aware of in a pretty frightening way. In 2011, there was an enormous flood that basically wiped out all the life in the riverbed.
I remember that flood.
Right. So that was Irene. But then in 2012, there was another flood that was equally destructive. It wasn't a hurricane. It was more like a cloudburst. But again, it was incredibly destructive. And I said, wow, this is what global warming has done to the weather patterns. We're driving the environment crazy. So my paintings are phrases, words, ideas that are bouncing around in my mind. My technique is I write the phrase, the word on a template, and then I paint that onto the painting. And, you know, through multiple layers, I get a rendition of that word that's sort of legible, sort of not. I want people to actually look at the painting and not read it. Fun fact, when you start reading something, your brain switches to something quite different than if you're just looking at something, right? So I try to fudge with the lettering a little bit so that you're looking at the painting more than the lettering, but then the title gives it. So for example, there's one painting that I did called The West Branch of the Neversink Goes Rogue, which was about my experience with all the flooding that happened in 2011 and 2012. Then there are other phrases that are about the invasive species, which are degrading the environment in Frost Valley. There's the woolly adelgid, which is a pest that destroys the hemlocks. There's Japanese knotweed. So there's all these aspects about what's happening to the environment in Frost Valley that I basically paint as words in my paintings.
And if I remember correctly, do you use some sort of screen?
That's right. Yeah, thank you for asking. So what I do is I use a fiberglass mesh, and I'll take the paint and I'll squeegee the paint through the mesh and then I'll pull it off. But I'll do this in successive layers. So what you get is a very tactile surface. It's something that you want to touch as much as look at.
I remember that.
Yeah. And part of the point is to actually make you think about what the actual object is. I think we're so used to looking at screens and dealing with virtual reality that we don't think about the actual object. And I'm trying to bring people back to the reality of the painting in a way, in a roundabout way of saying, you know, when you think about the environment, it is something real that we're dealing with.
And some of your work will be in Ellenville this weekend. So tell us about that and what the Material Arts Project is.
Sure. I really respect Kelly O'Brien's practice because she has made it her mission to only use sustainable art materials, which is a tall order. So she uses products like agar, you know, naturally sourced, literally plants, but also she'll make things out of mushroom mycelium. Very, very impressive work. And she asked me if I'd be interested in trying to make an artwork that was ethically sourced. And I said, great, challenge accepted. So what I'll be showing at Material Projects is there are these big, I call them banners. They're large pieces of cloth. In this case, it's a cheesecloth, a very tight weave of cheesecloth. Cheesecloth has different tightnesses of weave. So I use the tightest weave cheesecloth, and I use ethically sourced acrylic paint, which means it's paint that's not derived from petroleum product. It's actually derived from plant sources. These works are also part of the Crazy River Project because they refer to aspects of dealing with climate change. In this case, it's a more general approach. I'm thinking about what it means to actually adapt to an environment and what are our choices dealing with the future of climate change.
That's Thursday the 25th through Monday the 29th in Ellenville, and it's part of the Upstate Arts Weekend, and that means that Material Project Space is open to the public for all those days.
That's right. You can come in during those times. We'd love to see you. We'll be having an opening on Friday evening from 5 to 7. You know, come in for a beer, come in for a wine. I'll be there with Kelly, and we'd be happy to talk to you about the work. And also, you can go into the back of her studio and look at some of the amazing things that she does. I highly recommend, you know, seeing what she has to make because it's remarkable.
What she makes is so interesting and beautiful. And when you realize the source of her materials, it enhances it further.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming in again and sharing all these wonderful things you're involved with.
My pleasure, Valerie. It's always good to talk to you.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Valerie Manzi for that report. We'll take a break and come back with the Pussycat Lounge's first anniversary, the role of queer community spaces in rural areas, and this Friday's Pride celebration in Berryville. This is Radio Chatsco.
This week on the Retro Cocktail Hour, Frank Sinatra's in South America. There's music from the Dawn of Tiki. And the Waikiki 7 play the national anthem of exotica music. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. A monthly queer gathering in Berryville is celebrating a major milestone this Pride Month. The Pussycat Lounge returns to the Stick It In Cafe on Friday for a special one-year anniversary edition. The event has become a regular gathering place for LGBTQ+ community members and allies in the Upper Delaware River Valley. And the celebration will feature a free performance by Basic Bitches, who are Naomi Scott on guitar and vocals and Crystal Groh on drums and vocals. The event also marks Naomi's birthday. Naomi and Crystal join us now. Hi.
Hi.
Happy early birthday.
It's actually today.
It is.
Yes.
Oh,
so you're right on time.
Happy birthday. Happy Pride.
We're celebrating.
Here we go.
Oh,
it's all
it.
Happening.
So let's talk about the Pussycat Lounge for folks who may not be familiar with that. What is it? How did it get started a year ago?
Well, I think we just saw an opportunity to create a space, you know, a sort of casual but consistent space for, you know, women, you know, queer women, trans women, people who sort of identify as non-binary or sort of more femme presenting, just like an open, welcoming space for people to come and hang out and just kind of get to know each other and really start to build that community. I mean, you know, historically, women have been sort of on the margins of the broader gay community and, you know, we just wanted to try and make space for that. So we've really figured that there was, if anybody could do it, why not us? We live in Berryville. People know it's us. People know that we're in the band. People know that we want to participate. And we want to sort of make as much room as we can. So that was where it came from. And I will say, Naomi's really been the driver of all of this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are obviously, there's a large and, well, maybe not large, but there's a decent-sized queer community up here, and there are already a plethora of queer events happening, and we just felt that there was maybe a little bit of a gap in there for people who wanted to hang out in a slightly more low-key, not speedo-orientated.
Well, you know, we're talking about creating queer spaces in a rural community.
Right. Exactly.
Did it surprise you about the number of folks who identify as queer in this area? And what's the response been in the past year to this event?
It's been great. I mean, we've we've met a whole bunch of people that we didn't know were out there. Mm-hmm. And we've also sort of like got to hang out with people that we did know, but not particularly well. And we've definitely like helped people meet each other. People have gotten jobs. People have, you know, made new friends. It's been very, very cool to see.
Yeah, as like sort of a networking opportunity in a, like you said, in rural areas where we're not always the most connected and we're not always the most sort of aligned. It was really nice for us to discover that there are people that we don't know, you know, and to like make that space for people to come out and know that they could either see people that they don't see all the time, but they sort of know, and meet new people and sort of exchange ideas and information and just like sort of exist in this like nice little place that has become the Pussycat Lounge. And we're just happy that we've been able to do it and that people were responsive and receptive and open to it.
Have you seen the audience or community evolve since founding this a year ago?
Yeah. I mean, we've seen it. We've seen some people who have pretty much come to every single one. Mm-hmm. And then we've had people dip in. There's been, I mean, at the last one, there was somebody who had literally just taken possession of a home
right.
she had inherited and was not staying that night, but saw that we were happening. So popped in to say hi to everyone because she's about to move to the area. And, you know, that kind of stuff has been very, very, very cool.
Yeah. And for just people to kind of roam in and show up and say like, oh, this is... Whoa, this is really cool. I didn't know that this was a thing here. Yeah. I didn't know that Barryville.
Not known exactly as the nightlife capital of
exactly,
the world.
Exactly, right, right, yeah.
Changing.
Yes, definitely.
You know, I remember like years ago when I came up and I was looking around the region and I didn't know the area at mm-hmm. all, but I got invited up here by a couple of friends who had been up here and they had invited me to this party and I was like, oh, wow, I'm discovering this community I didn't know was here.
Right.
I think that for people in all different types of community discovery, that right, but why is it so important, especially during Pride Month, to have this LGBTQ+ space for folks? And why does it matter so much?
I think it can feel quite alienating up here. Lonely. I think
isolating.
Coming up here, right. yeah. isolating is
well,
a better
it's such
word.
Such a broad region,
right.
So,
right? I mean, there's that also, and obviously there are various online. The UDC, Facebook groups, et cetera, where people can make connections. But, you know, touch grass, everybody, that Facebook isn't real life.
Right.
Like social media, yeah.
Social media brings out the best and the worst in us, and it's not always the best way to make community. Mm-hmm. Like, looking people face to face, having a conversation, sharing values is how we truly make community. And I grew up in rural England. And the only other queer people I knew were related to me.
Were you the only gay in the village?
No, because I had two gay relatives in my immediate family, but we were the only three gays in the village. See, my brother's listening now. Hi, Harry.
Hi, Harry. This is my reference to a British sketch comedy.
Yes,
show.
Right,
okay,
yes.
Great. Thanks. I was wondering if you got it. Okay.
Oh, I got it.
So Basic Bitch is the friendliest riot girl band in Barryville is performing as well. For folks who may not be familiar with your music, and they should be, tell them a little bit about what your band is like.
Yeah, well, you know, I like to say we're sort of loud, fast, and fun. but it's we're leaning more into kind of a garage rock style with some hints of feminist punk rock, really bringing the energy, but not at the expense of entertainment. You know, we want people to have a good time. We want people to come to Basic Bitches shows and we want people to have fun. And I think that's another important reason, you know, why we want to make these spaces, because queer joy is important. It's necessary. It's needed. And right now in the world that we live in, like any opportunity that we can provide for us to sort of congregate and celebrate and be loud and take up space is worth it and is important.
Yeah, so we're going to be playing at 7 p.m. on Friday. The sun will still be up. Mm-hmm. We're playing outside. There's going to be plenty of space. Come out, bring your friends, bring your kids, bring your dogs, bring your dad.
Yeah.
Everybody is welcome. It's a queer space, but we welcome allies. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be super, super fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for someone who's listening or maybe you've never attended before and maybe don't identify as queer or maybe think they don't fit in, what's your message?
Oh, everybody, we always end every show by saying we're basic bitches and so are all of you. And that's really, you know, it's a broad congregation.
Right, yeah. The tent is big enough for all of us, and we're just happy to be able to be one part of the sideshow attraction.
And just before we go, I just want to also mention, the local businesses like Stick It In, how that's important to help create this space.
Yeah, the guys at Stick It In, Johnny and Roswell, they've been really great just allowing us to, you know, once a month just sort of take over the Stick It In Cafe and turn it into the Pussycat Lounge. And, you know, that's very, very valuable, having somebody that will allow you to just create a space. Mm-hmm.
And do you guys play every month, or is this just a special thing for this
celebration?
This is a special
Pride occasion.
Birthday. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I don't know if you've been to Stick It In Cafe. It's quite small. Yes. I think if we played inside, it would be a lot.
Right, yeah.
So in a normal gathering, is it just like drinks and fun and some background music?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a few events. We've had tarot readings. We've had stand-up comedy.
Did flash tattoos?
Oh, yeah, we've got
matching.
Yeah,
we've got matching
tattoos. We did karaoke. You know, sometimes it's just
a
casual hang.
We did
a book swap last time. Sometimes we'll add in a little activity. Yeah, we're easy. We're also, you know, happy to listen to if anybody's got any ideas for events. Hit us up. We're always looking for new ideas. And yeah, come and say hi.
Do folks have to bring a birthday gift?
They don't have to.
But you're not discouraging.
Exactly, right.
Let's remind folks again of where they can get more information and the event.
Yeah, I mean, the Pussycat Lounge is a slightly complicated Instagram. It's like PCL_upstate, I think. But Basic Bitches Band is easier to find on Instagram. We'll be at the Stick It In Cafe, which is on Route 97 in Barrieville. We'll be there from 5, but the live music is at 7. It's free entry and everybody is welcome.
That's Naomi Scott and Crystal Grove from Basic Bitches. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
Yay.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville and at vintagehousejville.com. And from listeners like you.
This week on Cats Cast, it's peak hiking season in the Catskills, and hiking guide and mountain historian Paul Misko has the gear list and practical advice to help keep you on the trail and out of trouble.
I met one fellow. He didn't want to carry anything, and his reasoning was, nothing's ever happened to me. And I hope you can see the lack of logic in that response.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
Summer is here and we're ready to boogie at the Radio Catskill Dance Party happening Saturday under the stars at the Coshecton Pump House featuring Radio Catskill DJs. Jason Tuga of The Mixtape with dance classics from the 70s through the 90s and Jeff Barnes of Electric Mountain spinning techno, house, and indie beats. Come out and dance with Radio Catskill this Saturday, 7 to 10 at the Coshecton Pump House. $10 suggested donation at the door.
Keeping an eye out of the weather for that event because it's open air there at the Pump House. Looking ahead, it looks like currently the forecast is just sun and some clouds on Saturday, but fingers crossed. Today, mostly sunny and nice, high 76. Clear tonight and a low of 51. And for tomorrow, an afternoon thunderstorm possible, high 76 with some showers lingering into the evening. For Friday, a brief shower or two as well, and a high of 78. On Point is coming up next.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills. From inpatient and outpatient care to primary, urgent, and specialty care with Garnet Health doctors in Sullivan County. Exceptional lives here. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Feel like you're just spinning in an endless whirlpool of information? We can help steady you. I'm Brooke Gladstone, co-host of On the Media, and we point out where you should be paying attention and what you can afford to ignore. Using the media as a lens on our world, we reveal nuance and detail often missed by other outlets. So don't miss On the Media, Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Hello, Radio Catskill listeners. This is Andy Carlson, and I'm inviting you to join me Thursday nights for 2 hours of genre-bending exploration of the American rock songbook on Ramble Tamble. I'll be bringing you everything from John Prine to PJ Harvey, Steely Dan to Steppenwolf, and just about everything in between. That's Ramble Tamble, Thursday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.